I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Residents in the Kansas City metro area are being asked to weigh in on public transportation and what's important to them. Today, the survey residents are being asked to take for the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority. As it prepares for a large system redesign, the input will be used to create mobility options to better serve the needs and priorities of area citizens. We'll hear from the authority's CEO about the plans to overhaul public transit in Kansas City. Then, the Truman Library and Museum is undergoing a year-long multi-million-dollar renovation. Hear how the project will add space and exhibits to provide a more interactive experience for visitors. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The area's bus system is changing. The Kansas City Area Transportation Authority has launched one of the largest system redesigns in the agency's history. It's called Ride KC Next. We're talking new routes, new thinking, new open-door policies, all wrapped up into a need to cut costs. Some will say it's about time for a system that's long been blamed as inefficient and a poor connector between many Kansas Cityans and their jobs. To that end, the system is conducting a survey of residents to see what their priorities are when it comes to transit. Here to talk about Ride KC Next is Robbie Mackinnon. He's president and chief executive officer of the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority. Robbie, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You know, there's a lot going on with your agency. Let's get right to it. The overall question is, why does Kansas City have such a problem with public transportation?
Well, actually, we're spread out in such a big region,
yeah.
So you have to make that choice between coverage or efficiency, and those are tough choices to make. Now, if you just want to be, you talk about just a bus redesign, that's only part of this. The bus redesign comes first, and then it's a matter of the second prong, which is bringing in the private sector to help fill the gaps. We need to let everybody in the tent. We need the private sector to come in and help with this rather than us just trying to act like the problem in this region has always been. It's always one versus the other. Mm-hmm. It's streetcar versus bus, bus versus Uber, Uber versus scooter. We've got to stop thinking like that because at the end of the day, you just want options and you want access. And if you put all those things together to where you can make that choice, you're more apt to use public transit.
You know, the knock on the system has long been that it doesn't connect residents with their jobs. Is that a fair criticism?
Yeah, it's a fair criticism. The fact of the matter is, I mean, let's be honest. People go out into a green field out in Gardner, Edgerton, or wherever that may be up north. You build a big building, you hire 1,600 people, and then 6 months later you walk out your door and say, our public transit system stinks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, public transit can no longer be an afterthought. It has to be a part of the incentives package, if you will, a part of the infrastructure when you talk about economic development from the beginning. And that's what we're trying to do, and then work with the private sector, work with the Greater Kansas City Chamber, now the Transportation Big Five, on workforce access. Look, our system, let's be honest, has been, just like every other system in a nation, has been politically engineered over the years.
What does that mean? I was going to ask you about that term, politically engineered. What does that mean?
Well, that means, you know, over the years, councilperson so-and-so or a county commissioner so-and-so says, hey, I need a route for my constituents over here. And then, you know, we come in and go, hey, this route has, you got a 40-foot bus and there's two people on it.
Mm-hmm.
How did that get there? I don't know. It's just always been there. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Our top 15 routes carry 75% of our folks. Our bottom 15, 2.
Wow.
Okay. It is high time, you know, obviously getting everything together inside the house, but now it's time to go outside the house and right this ship. And I think we're in a great spot to be able to do that with using the private sector, too, to come in and help.
You know, tell us about the survey the agency is conducting that I mentioned in the opening here, Robbie. What type of feedback are you looking for? How can citizens take part?
You know, would love anybody to go to the Ride KC website or go to RideKCNext.org
mm-hmm.
and take the survey. What we're asking is, what do you want your public transit system to be over the next 20 to 30 years? Look, you know, right now we're sitting not the last 20, okay? Mm-hmm. The last time, like you said earlier, the last time we've attempted something like this, or the ATA attempted something like this, was I can't even remember when, okay? We've got to do that. And with this survey, what we would like is not only customers, not only riders now, but people who don't ride. What could you do? What could we do to make you want to use public transit?
How long do citizens have to take the survey?
Till the end of July, and then we're going to put that stuff together. We're having more workshops. We'll have a lot of data together by September, and then come back out to the citizens of the region and talk through what we found out and put our plan together.
I was going to say, how much input, how much impact will the citizens have through this survey at the end of the day?
They have to. Okay, because they are your customers. Look, the mentality we've changed at Ride KC is if you just want to make a living, that's probably not a place for you to come work for us. If you want to make a difference while you're making a living, because at the end of the day, it's about people. It's not about inanimate objects going up and down the street, rubber, steel, aluminum. It's about people, and it's about the fact that you, as a transit agency, you affect people's lives every day. Mm-hmm. And so it's critical that they have the biggest impact in building what this new transportation system will look like for the next 20 years.
You know, besides coming on KCUR's Up to Date, are you doing anything else to let people know about the survey and encouraging them to take part?
Well, this is probably the biggest thing I could do, right?
There you go. You know. There you go.
But
instant impact.
But aside from this,
yeah,
we're having a lot of workshops. We've had some down at Union Station at the Chamber Boardroom. We're going around to different neighborhood groups, and we're trying to gather as much information as we possibly can.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago, Robbie, the impact of programs and services like Uber and Lyft and how that's affecting the public transportation industry, not just here in Kansas City, but across the country. Is your ridership down? What's been the impact?
Well, if you just look at straight bus service and bus ridership, you would say yes, that it's down. But if you look at ridership throughout our region as a whole, including streetcar, including other modes, it's going through the roof. And that is the point. Back to what I said, we've got to be mode agnostic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is, you, Steve, you just want access. You want options. And if you can take a streetcar and then get on a microtransit or Ride KC Freedom, and then, you know, I've got some people that take the MAX line and then jump on a scooter to come to work. Okay, whatever's best for you, the more options you have, the more apt you are to use public transit.
Talk in layman's language here, Robbie. Those different options you're alluding to, those are things like what?
We've started a microtransit program
in
Johnson County. Microtransit is an on-demand type service where, let's say you got to the end of your line on a bus, and then you called ahead, and then microtransit, it's a curb-to-curb service like an Uber or a Lyft, only done with the agency itself. We have a Ride KC Freedom On Demand, which is unique in the nation because we designed it around our paratransit service, our folks with diverse abilities, I say, instead of disabilities. And so now I get the same service you get. It's a Ride KC, so it's not Uber or Lyft. Our drivers are vetted, if you will, and I can take that service as well as you can too. These are unique things that if we tie them in with a streetcar and with the bus system, we're going to have a lot more options, and I think we can bridge that gap between coverage and efficiency.
Robbie Mackinnon is my guest. He's president and chief executive officer of the Kansas Area Transportation Authority, going through a huge redesign here. If you have questions or comments for Robbie, things he needs to hear, give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So what's the budget for the redesign you're talking about here, Robbie? Is it enough to make the impact that you're looking for?
Well, what we've done inside the house is we have combed through our budget now using some private sector folks who have come in and just really gone through the nuts and bolts. The bureaucracy of what the ATA and Ride KC had been over the years is unbelievable. I mean, I'm going to be real honest. Every time you pick up a rock, there was another snake under it. Okay, but the fact is, we're getting all that together. I would rather, rather than buying, you know, 10 seats at a table at so-and-so's chamber dinner, you know what? Let's take that money and put it on the street because that's where it belongs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's making those kind of choices, looking at your budget down to the Post-it notes, and remembering that this is about people, and that's where you've got to spend your money.
Yeah. How long do you anticipate this redesign to take, and how different will the program look, once you get done?
Well, what I'm excited about is like the microtransit I was telling you about in Johnson County, we're looking at those kind of things north of the river, too. So being able to combine bus service with streetcar service and those microtransit, new innovative type approaches, Ride KC Freedom, is going to put us in a place by the end of the year to where next year we should come out and you should see a pretty significant change, and change for the better, in Ride KC as a whole.
You're saying that this system in Kansas City will ultimately emerge as what? One of the most innovative in the country?
Well, it absolutely is. And let's talk about away from the system for just a second. Let's talk about people again. We were the first ones in the nation. Public transit is free for all military personnel, all of them, within the region. Mm-hmm. Johnson County, Wyandotte County, everywhere.
We were the first to go there?
Yes, and we still do it. And we've had over 2 million rides by veterans, okay, which is fantastic. We started a program where the Kansas City Center in Hickman, we did a pilot program with them for free transit for the school kids, high school kids. And mm-hmm. we've hit 40 or 50,000 trips just in the last couple of months of the school year. We've added North Kansas City to that for next year. We're getting ready to come out with our new mayor who's helped us, Mr. Lucas. Mayor Lucas is a safety net provider deal. Okay. My point is, if the ATA can diversify its funding streams in these different areas, that allows us a lot more leeway to try new things. And so, and innovative approaches from a people standpoint, but also innovative approaches from a service standpoint, too.
Now, speaking of money, you also want to reduce costs by 3%. How are you going to manage that?
It's just doing more with less, okay? It's a matter of being efficient, not only with the service itself, but efficient within the office itself.
Why do you have to reduce costs?
Well, why not? It's not about reducing costs as much as it is about putting the money where it belongs, all right? Well, you got a huge budget, and you're dealing in, paperclips and management personnel and all this kind of stuff when the money needs to be on the street.
But who's telling you? Is it just a general sense that you have as its leader that costs need to be reduced, or is the city saying you need to cut your budget back, or what's driving that?
You know, the city's been absolutely fantastic. They've been a fantastic partner, and I'm going to, someone's going to yell at me for this, but you know what? Public transit needs to be free as far as I'm concerned. Okay, and if we can start cutting costs, if we can get into that realm, I think it's an apple that we can really take a bite out of, and wouldn't that be exciting?
I was going to say, why should it be free?
Why not? Okay. The fact of the matter is, why should Mrs. Johnson have to ride Prospect Max and pay $1.50? Okay. Here's a good example. 85% of anything that happens bad, all right, violence or assault or anything like that, 85% of those are over $1.50. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why do I want to put the citizens of Kansas City at risk and or my operators over $1.50, okay? Not to mention the money that it costs to do new fare boxes, not to mention the money it costs to loss of work time for stuff that happens to people, the legal process, all those kind of things. If you add it all up, why wouldn't you, okay? And if everybody had options, and if everybody had access, and if everybody had access to the region for free, imagine what that could do for workforce flows. Transit is that one thing. It connects everything. You want to, mayoral candidates talk about affordable housing. You can't have affordable housing without public transit, okay? Mm-hmm. It's a piece. You can't have job access without public transit.
Is the Kansas City streetcar experience with a free system, is that giving you a new sense of motivation to make the entire system free?
Well, sure it has. Okay, the Kansas City streetcar is a phenomenon. Okay, Tom Guerin and the group down there have done a fantastic job with that. We're obviously helping them a lot in getting that thing expanded. And so, why shouldn't it be? Okay, if you can ride that free, why should Mrs. Johnson on Prospect have to pay $1.50?
Is any major public transit system in the country free right now, Robbie?
I think people have tried it in smaller systems. Okay, but I'm sorry, but I can't see anymore. So I look at things a different way than most mm-hmm. people do. And I look at the ATA as and our transportation service as a social service.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what you're talking about is the fact that you're legally blind, right?
Yeah, well, that's can you be illegally blind?
Well, let's start today. You're illegally blind. 816-235-2888 is our number. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air with Robbie Mackinnon of the KCATA.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you. This is actually Imani. And I'm really curious as to why there's never been, to my recollection, a bus that goes from 18th Street from the Jazz District down to downtown. It really seems, especially for First Friday, that would be, you'd have a great ridership, and it just seems as though it's really isolating the east side of that part of the city, that the Jazz District is just, you know, cut off from the downtown activity because there's 18th Street bus.
I bet the Jazz District people would like that, Imani. Robbie, what do you think?
Well, I'll go one step better for you. Okay, in between that crossroads and the Jazz District is the KCATA, 24 acres of what I would consider great economic development potential. Okay, and if there was a way that that land could be used as a conduit to bring those two together, that's something we're absolutely willing to talk about.
I was going to say, that's been talked about now for some time, you guys actually moving the bus center somewhere else and turning that area into something else that, again, might attract crowds and
absolutely
push them over to the east side.
Hello?
Yeah, Imani, go. Yeah.
You just completely blew-bassed my question.
No. I did not. I
would.
I apologize. Yes, we are going to do that. And plus, what we want to do on 18th Street is actually use that as a program site to do some innovative approaches with autonomous vehicles, too. So you're absolutely right. The ridership there would be fantastic, and it needs to be there. And that's part of our redesign, and that's one of the things that was on the top of our list on the first page there about connecting the crossroads with 18th and Vine, because you're absolutely right. It has to be
done. Thank you for answering my question.
Yes,
thanks,
ma'am.
Imani. Yeah. You mentioned autonomous vehicles. Is that driverless vehicles?
Yes.
And where does that stand in public transit systems across the country? Is that going to be a new tool soon?
Well, maybe. I mean, they still have attendants in them, okay? Mm-hmm. But I rode one down in Nashville, and it's not so much the software and all that. It's the how you perceive it. Okay, mm-hmm. as an individual, I rode with a guy who could see. I loved it. He was terrified, right?
So it's those
kind of things. But it's nice to bring them into town. Let's kick the tires on them. Let people see them as kind of a pilot type deal and get everybody's opinion of them.
You're saying the question is whether passengers and citizens will trust those enough to get in them and be driven wherever they're going.
That's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Back to some phone calls here. Dennis from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Robbie Mackinnon, Dennis.
Hi. Really enthused to talk about this subject. I have a problem with some of the community business owners' attitudes about public transportation.
So do I.
I was talking to one fellow north of the river. He owns a restaurant up there, / bar. And he said to me that, we were just talking in general about public transportation. He said that if we put in public transportation, only poor people will use it.
Okay, you know, I get so sick and tired of that. I really, really do.
Why?
Well, because it's just unfair, okay? The fact of the matter is, well, everybody can sit around and you can talk about, oh, we need to get millennials riding public transit. We need to do this and do that. I got it. You know what? We're not going to run away from the people that need us every day, all right? Mm-hmm. We're going to run towards them. Mm-hmm. And it's a fact that 75% of the people that ride public transit right now are riding it to school, are riding it to work. And, you know, you can sit there and you can say, okay, well, I see other people around the nation, they want to take a bus and say, okay, well, let's put a bell on it instead of a horn. Let's cover the wheel so everybody thinks it's a straight. It's a bus. Get over it,
yeah.
Right? Okay?
Well,
but the fact of the matter is we need it.
There's a lot more education that needs to happen because, I mean, we face it, the Midwest is not a place where public transportation has been a part of life. Like in big cities on the East and West Coast or in Europe.
Dennis, you're absolutely right. And part of that problem is not the public's fault. It's our fault. It's our fault for taking an ATA, taking a bi-state compact that was approved by Congress in the 60s and turning it into just a small-time bus company. Okay, it's a transit authority. Use it. Okay, use it. Bring all these modes together. 3 and 4 years ago, we didn't have a map of all the transit we had in the region from Johnson County to wherever. That was just 4 years ago. Okay, so we've hit the gas and gone light speed to get where we are now, but we're not stopping now.
Dennis, thank you for the call.
Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, appreciate it. How does Kansas City ridership compare to other major cities? You know, is there a per capita comparison that would be something akin to apples here, Robbie?
Everybody, you know, bus service itself is ridership has been down, but that's down because, you know, there's other modes.
But does Kansas City ride public transit less? Do Kansas Cityans ride it less than other big cities?
No, I'm still looking at bus service itself. I'm still looking at over 15 million rides a year. Okay, mm-hmm. That's important for a city this size in a region this size.
You also want to move away from cash payments, and I'm wondering why. I mean, what about senior citizens who don't use smartphones, who aren't familiar with apps, that kind of thing?
Well, we always we can always bridge that digital divide with a phone call. Okay, to our call center, like a lot of people do now. Mm-hmm. So being able to do that is obviously very important. But you know what? I want cash off the bus. I want it off the bus totally.
Because
okay?
Because it's also a threat in some ways for robbery, that kind of thing?
Well, it's a threat for robbery, a threat for confrontations. If somebody does, it's a threat for efficiency while somebody's digging in their
right.
pocket to try and find a $1.50. It's just, you know, there's just so much. And it's not that – I'm not saying public transit should be free. I'm just saying it should be free to the customer, mm-hmm. okay? Like, for example, with the Veterans Project we do, the VA, and they come in and help with that. With the school districts, they come in and help with that. It's that kind of thing. So you're diversifying your funding streams, but at the end of the day, the customer, him or herself, doesn't have to worry about that. And if you don't have to worry about that, and then you can go to Mobility as a Service to where eventually we have an app to where you, Steve, can plan your day. All right, I want to go from here to here. Here are my options. I can pick this option. I can take a bus here. I can take a scooter. I can take a streetcar. My options, I get to pick, then you're more up to you.
How close are you to a cashless system?
Well, you know, I want it tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
But,
okay.
Yeah, we're pushing.
Gail from Baser, you're on with Robbie Mackinnon from the Kansas City ATA. Gail, good morning.
Hey, this is Crazy Gail. I don't know if this is smart or stupid, but has he applied or looked up the possibility of getting a grant from the federal government to assist in paying for advertising or whatever to get a free program or a maybe not free but reduced program or something to get people out of their cars?
I'm you know, guessing he has, yeah.
Absolutely. We try and you know, go after every federal grant we can possibly get our hands on. Here's the fun part. You say you're crazy. I'm crazy, okay? When I go to those you know, public transit conferences and whatever, I'm speaking treason to most of those guys. I'm scaring the heck out of them when I talk. Mm-hmm. But that's how you know, change comes at the end of your comfort zone, okay? Welcome to the end of your comfort zone. That's where innovation, that's where progress, that's where everything lives. Let's keep pushing forward.
Final point, Robbie, you also have a $56 million Prospect Max bus rapid transit project set to open later on this year. How big a deal will that be?
It's a huge deal, okay? The Prospect Max is going to be the jewel in the crown of the bus service itself.
Why is that, and what is Max again? Remind our listeners.
You know, Max is an express service. Mm-hmm. It's our biggest ridership, like on, you know, was on Main and Troost, and Prospect is the next deal in that. But here's why it's different. It's different because the technology we're using from conductive concrete, where you can, you know, it's heated so that snow and ice won't get on it. The fact that we're going to have Wi-Fi all down the line. The fact that we're going to have wayfinding for folks like myself with diverse abilities to be able to use that service. Also, the economic development aspect. The ATA now is picking up properties along with the city along that corridor. Again, another way we can generate revenue, ridership, and relationships. That's my three R's. And if it meets those criteria, it's something we want to talk about. So being able to take those parcels and you know, RFP them out for developers or whatever so we can generate a little revenue and ridership is another way to diversify, as well as help the city grow and become a little more dense also.
One more question for Robbie Mackinnon. Catherine from Brookside, you're on the air.
What are your innovative plans for helping the aging population use public transit?
Fantastic
Good
question.
Good question, yeah.
I look at that like I look at folks like myself who need help. The innovative project is that we haven't really marketed out to the general public yet is what we have started with RideKC Freedom On Demand. It is an Uber-type service, only it's done with a RideKC app, a RideKC Freedom app. And right now our folks with diverse abilities use it. It's an on-demand service for paratransit service, and that is very unique and does not happen very often. What we need to do now and what we're going to do is now make it available for you too and for our aging populations. And where that will work is out in the suburbs even more, I believe, because, you know, my mom out in eastern Jackson County is not going to take an Uber because she thinks it's a serial killer, right? But she'll take RideKC because, it's part of the agency. That driver's been vetted. You know what I mean? So having those kind of having that kind of access to where you can again get to a main route or get to any other service center is a critical path. That's why the redesign is so important. Right. That's why it's great.
That's Robbie Mackinnon, president and CEO of the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority. Lots of big plans ahead. Robbie, thanks for sharing them with us, and you need to come back and tell us how you're doing in a few months, okay?
I'd love to. Thank you, sir.
Speaking of big plans, the Harry Truman Presidential Library and Museum has a bunch of them too. We'll talk about it after a break. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we talked with campaign managers about what it really takes to pull off a successful municipal campaign here in Kansas City. Hear that and previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Midwestern summers can be miserable, but what better way to cool down than with a cocktail by the pool? Winemaster Doug Frost is back with suggestions for the best adult summertime drinks. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library and Museum is getting a bright new look. The museum will undergo a multi-million dollar expansion and renovation that will require the museum to close for about a year, beginning on July 23rd. The objective is to upgrade the library's educational offerings and turn a visit to the Center in Independence into a must-see destination. New permanent exhibitions will be added, along with a state-of-the-art interactive experience. After all, the museum's director says the world may never again see a Missouri farmer transformed into President of the United States. All this is being done through a $25 million capital campaign that is about 90% funded. With us here to talk about this project, Clifton Truman Daniel is President Truman's grandson and the honorary chairman of the Truman Library Institute Board of Directors. He joins us from Someone Studios in Chicago. Clifton, nice to have you back again. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be here.
Dr. Kurt Graham is also here. He's in the studio with me. He's director of the Truman Library. Kurt, nice to have you, too.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What's envisioned here is a completely new look for the library, Clifton. Why is it needed?
I think you have to do this. Any institution like the Truman Library has to do it regularly. The timeline varies. But when you – any story that you were telling – any historical story you're telling needs updating, it needs to be freshened, and you need to start thinking about how you reach younger and younger generations, new generations coming along. So it always helps to go through what you do and look at it fresh, reimagine it, reorganize your material, bring it up to date, and make it meaningful to subsequent generations.
You know, Kurt, just to give our listeners context here, this is a big change. Tell us about just how big a change you're looking at here.
Well, it is. As Clifton said, we're not only reimagining the exhibits themselves, we're reimagining the whole institution. Mm-hmm. How do we connect to the community? How do we provide an entree into this incredible presidential legacy that we're so privileged in this community mm-hmm. to have?
So how is it going to be different? Give us just a broad overview here.
Well, the physical change to the library is going to involve a modest 3,000-square-foot expansion, new museum store, new entrance, new sort of visitor experience as you come in.
People walk in on the east side as opposed to walking in the front door now.
Absolutely. Yeah. You won't have to walk all the way around the building in all kinds of weather with walkers and strollers and wheelchairs and whatever else. But the thing is that you'll walk into a very large, spacious receiving area with a nice line of sight down to the graves and see that very serene offering there. But what I think most visitors will notice over what we have now is the incredible amount of multimedia and interactive experiences throughout the gallery. It's going to be an incredible learning experience for children, for students, but for people of all ages.
I was going to say, we live in an interactive world, and this library will be interactive going forward,
Absolutely.
It sounds like. Give me an example of what that looks like.
Well, there'll be a number of films, a number of media pieces where you come in and you're sort of immersed in a world. You'll start out, for example, in 1945, the first theater you walk into will be the world in crisis. And in the middle of that crisis, as you know, the world loses its leader, a leader who's been in place for a dozen years.
President Roosevelt.
President Roosevelt dies, and then all of a sudden there's this Missouri farmer that nobody knows anything about. And the question they asked in 1945 was, can he swing the job?
You know, Clifton, that question, that situation, talking about it to me never grows old.
Having taken over from Roosevelt?
Yeah, just an ordinary Missouri farmer. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm always – people – when I give speeches about Grandpa, people sometimes during question and answer period, they'll ask what I think his greatest accomplishment was. And I'm sure they expect me to say the Marshall Plan or the ending of the war in the Pacific, the Truman Doctrine. But I always wind up saying that I think his greatest accomplishment was showing us that a farmer, soldier, small businessman – can rise to the highest office in the land and do a better job of it than almost anybody else.
You know, David von Drayley, who's involved with this effort, writes on your website in a little passage that President Truman did a lot of stuff, Kurt, and he did. I mean, the world he took on, the challenges he took on in 1945 were just enormous.
It is breathtaking to consider just some basic facts. The map of the world is different today because this farmer from Missouri became president.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of things that he did, the way he went about doing them, he changed the course of history. And as Clifton said, it had never been it never gets tiring to talk about the fact that a basically ordinary person can do extraordinary things.
You know, it strikes me too, Clifton, that, you know, Republicans have good feelings about your grandfather, Democrats do. In an era of intense partisanship, this is one president that today seems to rise above it all, at least to some extent.
I think that's true, and that has actually always been true. Your grandpa spent his working vacations down in Key West, Florida, and we've been having presidential descendants visit down there and do programs for the last decade or so. And I get more Republicans to join me down there than I do Democrats.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, the short, snappy answer to that is it's Key West in February.
Okay. That takes a wind out of that whole line of questioning,
well,
doesn't
but
it?
Also, yeah. But also, I think it is true. It is true because Grandpa himself crossed party lines. One of his great friendships later in life was with Herbert Hoover. And the two of them, they would go out on the campaign trail when both were retired, 1956, 1960, and they'd say these horrible things about each other. And then one would call the other at the end of the day and say, you know, I don't mean any of that. And the other would say, yeah, it's politics.
Yeah.
So, but they maintained the civility. They maintained a working – and Grandpa had working relationships with across the aisle when he was in the Senate, when he was president.
Right, so, right. Kurt, do you have any serious infrastructure issues that need addressing with this renovation?
Well, our exhibits, the current exhibits that we have in the building now are coming up on 20 years old, which is a long time in the life cycle of a permanent exhibit. So if you're going to attract and maintain a relationship with new audiences, you've got to have something fresh. You've got to have something changing. You've got to have something. So the big thing that we're going to do is bring all of the Truman story up onto one level. So right now, in the lower level, we have his early life, but people encounter the presidency now as they go through the museum without knowing about Pendergast or about World War One or about Bess or about Jackson County politics or any of that. So we're going to incorporate all of that into a seamless story about Truman's entire life, his entire experience. And then in the lower level, we'll have rotating exhibit spaces that will allow us to have these visiting exhibits that are fresh and exciting, and we get, you know, some publicity around that. So that's the main thing that's going to be different is, I mean, the building is solid. I mean, we are adding on to it just to have some additional space. But, you know, there's always stuff like air handlers and things like that that need to be updated. And nobody realizes, you know, those aren't super exciting things. You know, donors don't say, wow, can I put my name on an air handler? But at the same time, it's important work that needs to be done to the building.
You know, Clifton, I think about the world of presidential libraries and museums. I think of the big changes at the Lincoln Center over in Springfield. The entire game, the pressure to sort of offer the public something intriguing and interesting, the pressure has really been ratcheted up in recent years, hasn't it?
It seems so, with especially Kurt was talking about this earlier with interactive technology and all of the just the things that we have come up with in our movies, in our museums, and our and it spills over into history and probably should. But that's the kind of thing. So making it, keeping it interesting. If you've, I don't know if you've been to the Lincoln Library. I took my family years ago. And just the, not just the interactive, but the way they have, and I don't even know what the technology is called. It was, and this is no disrespect to the folks at the Lincoln Library, but it was very Disney-esque. You have you have characters morphing out of walls. You have, you know, full-scale mock-ups of the cabin that Lincoln was born in. So it, a lot of whiz-bang, and that's something to keep up with.
Kurt, has attendance at the Truman Library been slacking of late?
Well, no, we've actually had some good years, and you know, we've had anniversaries to celebrate, like you know, the 70th of the war and that kind of thing. So we've had some great programs, and we've been able to have modest increases. But over time, yes, I mean, we're you need to have something new and exciting for people to come to, and it's not, you know. Clifton makes a great point there about, you know, a lot of times people think that, well, if we make it like a trip to Disneyland or Disney World, that's what people are going to want. That's not really the case. And that's not really what we want to incorporate these technologies, and we want to keep up with what people expect. But the reason people are going to come and the reason they're going to continue to engage with this is because of the quality of this story. This is a unique story. It's a uniquely American story. And, you know, I always think of the Walter Cronkite when he was narrating Truman's funeral coverage. And he said at the end of that, you know, he was a man uniquely of his time, and we will never see his like again.
That's interesting.
And I think people need to realize that there will never be another Harry Truman. There will never be another failed haberdasher who couldn't afford to go to college, who didn't have connections through the Yale Club or Harvard or whatever. There will never be anyone who's who doesn't have those connections who's going to rise to that office again.
We're talking about a major renovation of the Truman Library and Museum coming up. The library is going to close on July 23rd for a year to get this work done. We're joined by Dr. Kurt Graham. He's the director of the Truman Library, and Clifton Truman Daniel, who is Harry Truman's grandson. Your questions welcome, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Clifton, you're going to close this library and museum down for a year. Does that make you nervous at all, sort of shutting the whole thing down?
No, because the staff, the library, and the Library Institute have been working for years to expand the library's reach beyond Independence with programming in Kansas City and elsewhere. So it shutting the physical plant is, sure, it's always a little worrisome because you're going to be out of commission for a year. But two things, when the library does reopen again, it's going to be fantastic. And in the meantime, all of that outreach, all of that educational programming, it gives us a chance to focus on that almost exclusively, so even more than we have been. But the staff and the have done a great job of reaching outside the boundaries of Independence, which I think Grandpa would have loved.
And Steve, if I could just add to that, I think that's a major driver behind why we're doing this renovation, because this new and improved library experience that we're all so excited about is not only an end within itself, it becomes now a springboard or a launch pad or whatever metaphor you want to use into national and even international programming. We've forged relationships all over the world around Truman's legacy. You cannot go into that as an equal partner with a tired, dated offering at your home, mm-hmm. at your home base.
This is a $25 million project. How close are you to finishing off the fundraising?
We're getting very close. As you mentioned early on, we're about 90%, 23-something. I don't know the exact figure this day, but we're zeroing in on that.
Let's go to some phone calls and Murad from Independence. Murad, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the renovation of the Truman Museum. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. A very good topic, and I have a question. In redoing the museum and bringing it up to modern standards and the exhibits, there are some portions of history that really doesn't get told, and I'm wondering if that's going to be a part of this new museum. The bombs that were dropped and the decision to make those, they were dropped on civilian sites, not military sites, and the generals at the time were against dropping those bombs. Will that be a part of this museum?
Dr. Graham, what about Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
You know, that's always been a part of the Truman story, of course, and it will continue to be. That will be an important part of this, and we will be addressing a number of issues that I think I would say are underrepresented in the current offering, and that's part of it. As far as the bombs go, you know, there's a lot of scholarship, a lot of controversy, I suppose, then and now. The point that we make with this is that it wasn't controversial for Truman. Truman had to end a war. And that's how he looked at it.
He never looked back and second-guessed that decision.
No. He didn't lose any sleep. He didn't wring his hands. I mean, he was sobered by it. I think it affected his decisions later, like Korea, for example, when people mm-hmm. said, you know, you got the bomb, use it, get it over with. I think Truman exercised tremendous restraint based on being the only man who'd ever, you know, had to do something like he had to do to end the war. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the, you know, a museum exhibit is not a place to split hairs over the details of, I mean, that's we might have a program about the topic that the gentleman mentioned, you know, getting different scholarly perspectives or whatever. But to people don't come to a museum to do deep level research on, you know, there's 25, 30 questions, just like the one that was just asked, that you mm-hmm. could take up the whole exhibit mm-hmm. dealing with. And that will be better handled in programmatic and educational outreach.
Clifton, how often do you get asked the questions about the bombs when you're out presenting to people?
Fairly often. And I just wanted to add to that, two of the additions to the atomic bomb exhibit. My family and I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2012.
Yeah, we've talked about it on the show before, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, we were with former Hiroshima Mayor Akiba some years ago. And so we went to the ceremonies. We just sat down and listened to more than two dozen survivors tell us their stories. One of those survivors many of them have become friends, but one of them, Masahiro Sasaki, donated a tiny folded paper crane to the Truman Library, folded by his late sister, Sadako Sasaki, who was two when the bomb exploded. She was diagnosed with radiation-induced leukemia 9 years later. She folded 1,300 of these tiny paper cranes in an effort to the legend in Japan is that it grants you a long life or health. Hmm. She folded 1,300. She died of the leukemia, unfortunately. There's a monument to her and to all the children who were killed and sickened and wounded by the bomb in Hiroshima. Masahiro donated one of those cranes to the Truman Library. We also, a group in Hiroshima called Green Legacy Hiroshima, donated seedlings from trees that survived the bombing in Hiroshima that we will plant at the library. So there's reconciliation at the end of this. There's mm-hmm. always going to be the discussion over the bombings and whether right. they were necessary or not. But that's part of moving forward with the library. History goes on and people change their hearts and minds.
Let's go to Jake from South Kansas City. Jake, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Curious as to how much information there may be about President Truman's connection to survivors of the Civil War and some of their immediate descendants. There's a tremendous quote in the Central Library on the fifth floor. President Truman, I'm paraphrasing, talking about Quantrill. He'd said he'd met with a bunch of those boys and They weren't bad people. They were just trying to protect their families and their property. Just a real interesting take on the mess that was our border. But just curious.
What about President Truman's connection to the Civil War and how that'll be represented in the library, Kurt?
Well, obviously, it'll be done through his surprising civil rights legacy. But it's interesting you say that he had sort of an appreciation, I guess, for people that fought for their homeland. He went to Mexico, did the same thing for people who'd fought against the United States, went and laid a wreath and saluted soldiers who had died fighting the United States. And people questioned him. And he said, they were being loyal to their nation. They were serving, protecting their home, their family, whatever. They were doing what they thought was right. And I think what Harry Truman always valued in people was whether they would do what was right. And I think that's what we value about him. His civil rights legacy, as surprising as it was very real, to the point that Lyndon Johnson gave him a lot of credit for what Johnson himself accomplished in the 1960s. And Truman's reaction to that was, when I realize the way things were, you get out in the world. I tried to make a difference in terms of African Americans and their opportunities. But when I think back, I wish I'd done more.
Hmm. Kurt, just as an aside, Steve. Just the conflicted history of Missouri's borders was played out in the Truman family, because my grandfather, against the wishes of almost everybody else in his family, liked Abraham Lincoln, was a fan of Abraham Lincoln, and yet, when he wore his National Guard uniform to his grandmother's house the first time back in 1906, she kicked him out of the house because the uniform was blue. She said, get that damn Yankee uniform out of this house.
Wow.
So split even within the family.
Kurt, is the federal government kicking in any money for this project, or the state of Missouri? Does it work that way anymore?
It does work that way. It's not like the good old days when there were earmarks and things like that, where big money could come in. But we definitely have been able to use some federal funds to offset some of the design costs and some of the infrastructure with the building itself, which is very important. And then the state of Missouri recently appropriated $3 million toward this project for Missouri's only president. So we're very pleased and delighted. We also have the City of Independence, which is kicking in and helping us with on the construction side as well. So, no, we've had very good support at all levels of government.
A firm, Kurt, known as Gallagher & Associates, is doing this work. Who are they, and why was this company picked?
They're one of the major exhibit design firms in the country. They have offices in West Coast, East Coast, and actually in Asia as well. They've done a lot for the Smithsonian. They've done other presidential libraries. Top quality firm. We couldn't be more pleased with the quality of the design and the product that we're going to start building here in about a month.
Clifton, I'm wondering what concerns the Truman family had regarding the new design of the library and museum, and did the family want anything specifically preserved?
No. I think that the work that they've done, that the designers have done, has been fantastic. We're all looking forward to it.
Okay.
So just especially being able to park and walk right in.
Yeah, that'll be a big change. Maybe the most noticeable change right off the bat for
Now, Grandpa was the only one who could do that.
That's right. Well, that's the voice of Clifton Truman Daniel. He's President Truman's grandson, honorary chairman of the Truman Library Institute Board of Directors. We also were joined here in the studio by Dr. Kurt Graham, director of the Truman Library. Maybe we'll come out and do a show when you reopen a year from now. I'd like to do that.
That'd be fantastic. We've got
That'd be great, Steve.
In the Oval Office or his working office or something, and
We'll let you go behind the rope. Step all over.
That's
everything.
Right.
Be great.
I think I belong in the Oval Office.
That's right.
It's about time an ordinary man made it to the Oval Office.
An ordinary man
there
from Missouri. There you go.
Yeah, there you
just
go.
Just join the Democrats running, Steve. Yeah.
Everybody else is running.
Yeah,
thank you both for
a
good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, could an often overlooked part of Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act hold a key to encouraging investment in low-income communities? The Chamber of Commerce is drawing attention to the program. We'll ask about it. The show's produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.